this is going to be the first cast in our high performing teams series. And as a lot of people know, for me, high performing teams are a subject of particular interest, because as a project manager, one of my biggest challenges on any project is bringing a coherent team together in a relatively short period of time and getting them to perform at their optimum. And despite all of the things that people will tell you in project management theory, projects tend to fail less on technical and quality and safety issues, and more on communication and people issues where teams aren't performing. And it's particularly difficult with a project because you have teams within teams. And it is particularly difficult to pull that together into a coherent team. Anybody who's ever played sports, if you've done like rowing, it's one thing to get everybody in the boat. It's another thing to make sure that they're all facing the same way. It's then another thing to make sure that they're pulling their oars at the same time, and that they're pulling with equal energy. Otherwise, you're just going to end up going around in circles in the middle of the lake, and that's not very good. So my interest in teams prompted me to read a book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by a gentleman called Patrick Lencioni. And I recommend it highly. It's available in all good bookshops, and also as an audio book. And within that, Patrick Lencioni talks about his particular model of the five dysfunctions. And the way he sets the model out is it's like a pyramid, with the first dysfunction being on the bottom. And the idea being that each dysfunction builds on the previous. So you have to start off with the base layer, the foundations, and then you work up the model in terms of developing the team. And it's very interesting. So it's a triangle. What I'll do is I'll put some guidance notes on the website so that people can follow along as well. I've not actually drawn it as a pyramid. I've drawn it as a staircase, because I couldn't actually get the graphics for a pyramid, if I'm to be honest. Staircase I could do on Excel. It's easy. So the model works in that it talks about five elements that are missing or absent in some way within a team, and then talks about how those things are vital for ultimate team performance. And the five dysfunctions are an absence of trust, a fear of conflict, a lack of commitment, an avoidance of accountability, and an inattention to results. Now, for each one of those, there's a definition. We won't go into that today for all of them. Today is all going to be about the very first dysfunction, which is absence of trust. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast, with Lisa Hayton, Sophie Bryan, Gary Spinks, and myself, Ray Campion. Now, for the purposes of this, what Patrick means about trust is that, in his opinion, for the model to work, within a team, you need to be prepared to be vulnerable. And by vulnerable, he means that you need to be willing to admit that you've got some things wrong. You need to be willing to ask for help, and you need to be able to do that in an environment where you feel that you won't be judged, criticized, or otherwise sanctioned for that show of vulnerability. So that's what he means by trust, which is quite in itself is quite an interesting take. Because when you say trust to people, they often have completely different concept of what that means. So, trust. We're going to talk about trust. So, as I said, in this situation, trust is all about being vulnerable within a team. So I think maybe to kick it off, it would be interesting to hear if anybody's got any particular anecdotes around maybe a time where they worked in a team that had high levels of trust, or they worked in a team that had a significant absence of trust. What were the, compare and contrast those two scenarios and try and identify for us what you think was the difference in, between the two scenarios. What made one different to the other? Anybody want to go?
I'll go. I'll jump in, Ray, if that's okay.
Go.
I've worked in a team that had very little trust. And with that came a lot of backstabbing, came a lot of game playing, politics. And it's interesting that, you know, some of the other points around, you know, what makes a high performing team, there was some very clear evidence of lack of accountability. People just kind of having what I call slopey shoulders, just like, no, it lands on me and it just kind of slides straight off. And that was largely due to trust. That was because people were frightened for their jobs. They felt like they could only look after themselves because, you know, potentially their jobs could be at risk. They were threatened by new people that joined the team because what if they were more talented, more gifted, did better than them, in which case, you know, that was another threat to their job. So they kept themselves to themselves, didn't share information. Their job was very, very private. They would not tell any other teams that needed further information about what they were doing. And ultimately, they were not a high-performing team at all. In contrast to a team that were high performing, the key word that you said when you was describing what a high trust team looks like, for me, is vulnerability. And I worked in a team not long ago as part of a, you know, working with a client, and I inherited a team as I was working with this particular client. And we started from a place of vulnerability, and we started from a place of growth mindset. So talking about things that hadn't worked and why hadn't they worked and what could we learn from that, and actually what gift would that, was that mistake giving us? And because we approached things from that position where everyone felt safe to share that, the trust just got bigger and bigger and bigger, to the point where that team completely surpassed themselves in terms of what they were asked to deliver. And I think, there's so many things I could say about trust, because I talk about trust, you know, pretty much to every single client I talk to. It boils down to trust for me. But I see it from the model that Stephen R. Covey talks about with the emotional bank account, where he says that every interaction you have with somebody is either making a deposit into that person's emotional bank account, or you're making a withdrawal. And when you think of it like that from a trust perspective, everything you think, say, feel or do could potentially be building trust or could be taking a withdrawal of trust. And I use that a lot with leaders for them to be very mindful in how they're talking and how they're operating. Are they withdrawing trust or are they making a deposit for that person?
Can I drag you back, Sophie, to your where you were talking about you worked in a low trust environment?
Yeah.
What was going on there? Was that because, right, so I guess we probably all acknowledge that one of the biggest things that holds us back as individuals, but this becomes particularly stark when you become a manager, is our own vulnerabilities as we understand them in our own heads. Mm. And these can often be things that we're not even necessarily aware of, but we exhibit behaviors that maybe in hindsight, if we reflect on them, we think, oh, you know, that probably wasn't the best thing to do. You know, why did I do that? And sometimes these things are very, very deep seated and can actually stem from childhood. But that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
But in this, so one, I guess where I'm trying to go at this is one of the things we need to be aware of as individuals is that we come to a scenario and we come to a team with all sorts of baggage. And, and I say baggage in air quotes because I'm a bit nervous about using that term because it's got such negative connotations. Experience, life. We come to the workplace with life and we can't just shake it off and shake it down. In your scenario, was it a case of that there was individual baggage getting in the way, or was there something more cultural going on there?
Oh, it was definitely more cultural. I mean, most people do have some some areas in that space, I think you're describing, that are inherent in their personality that's come with their level of trust they've experienced as a child and so on and so forth. But for me, it was cultural, in that the leadership of that organisation were role modelling that behaviour. So they would have separate side conversations about other people. And they would say, "Oh, you know, Sophie, have you got 5 minutes?" "Yeah, yeah, I've got 5 minutes. What's going on with Hayley?" "What do you mean, what's going on with Hayley?" "Well, I don't know, she just seems really off at the minute. Like, what's going on? Do you know anything?" And this is senior management team doing this. And so they're like, "No, I don't really know about it." "What are you going to ask Hayley?" "Oh, no, I can't ask Hayley because I was talking to such and such and she thinks she's a bit annoyed with me." And it's just all these silly little conversations, whether it be about, is somebody annoyed with me? Is somebody a bit off? What's going on with this person? All the way down to, what's happening on this project? Do you know if we're on time? What is this person doing? You know, the amount of conversations I had from various different leads in the organisation where they were bad mouthing my colleagues to me. And so, you know, this, "Oh, look at this piece," and bring it up on the screen and show me pieces of work that my colleagues have done. "Look, can you believe they have turned? I can't believe they've done this piece of work." I'm thinking, well, if you're talking about my colleagues to me like this, how are you talking about me?
Yeah.
And so because that was role modeled, that's how the team then became. So then you had teams, individuals having micro conversations with each other because they had seen that happening from the top. And therefore, that's what they were doing. And they would then go off and say, "You know, well, do you know what's up with Sophie? What do you think she was talking to Lucy about in the office a minute ago?" And it got to the point, Ray, where the minute you got up out of your desk and walked into a member of the senior management team's office, whispers would start. "What do you think Sophie's gone in there for? Do you think she's telling them about that argument we had earlier? Would you?" And then as soon as you walk out, everyone's staring at you. And it's something that the organisation created. They created this culture, and they, because no one pulls anyone up on it, and because no one was saying, "I don't want to have this conversation with you. I'm not going to be party to this. Actually, I'm going to join in with this." It just bred further and further and further, and become an institutionalised way of working.
Mm. In his book, Patrick Lencioni, because one of the good things I like about the book is that at the beginning of the book, there's like an anecdote, a story, and it's designed to sort of explain the model in real time so that people can actually see how it would work in the real world. And one of the challenges they have in this particular team is that they're not operating as a team. So they quite often have side meetings, and not everybody in the team is invited to team meetings, and they talk about people in the meeting who aren't in the meeting. And
yep.
Now, yep. I've seen this before, and I suspect as well, I'm probably guilty of having done this myself in the past, whereby you talk to your team about wanting to have a team ethic and, you know, we're going to be a team and all this sort of thing. And then 5 minutes later, you're having side conversations with people about things that really should be discussed among the team. And like that, I mean, I used to do that and not even be aware that I was doing it. I'm far, far more conscious about it now and actually go out of my way to make sure I don't. But it happens a lot. And I've been part of teams where you walk out of a team meeting and like maybe one or two people are staying behind, and you know that they're talking about stuff that really ought to be discussed as a team. And you're thinking, well, hold on a minute. Is there teams within teams here? Because like, is there a core circle of trust team? And then there's the wider team, and it just breeds distrust and enhance. So if you're a little bit self-conscious or have a little bit of anxiety or vulnerability, it really plays on that, because it, it brings you back to your school days where maybe, you know, there was a group of kids whispering in the corner, and when you walked around the corner, they went quiet and stuff. And you, now they might not even have been talking about you, but we can all remember how that sort of a scenario felt. And to have that as adults in a, you know, you're not going to get people working collaboratively together if you've got that sort of thing going on, I should imagine.
I'll also just quickly add to that, Ray, and then I'll stop interjecting on this. But the point you just said about those micro team meetings that go on, that, you know, a few people hang back and you leave the room and you think, oh, gosh, are they talking about the fact I raised that point, et cetera, et cetera. Something really important that I do when I'm coaching action learning sets. So when I'm bringing groups of people together to talk about problems that need to be solved and I'm coaching them through that process, we agree on this rule at the very beginning of the session that whenever we take a break, we do not continue the discussion outside of the room.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are having a 10-minute coffee break, then that 10-minute coffee break is not to be speaking about the content of this meeting. It is to go away, have a chat about British Bake Off, have a chat about what you're watching on Netflix, the fact you've got to go home and pick your son up from swimming, whatever that looks like. That is what the break is for. We do not continue the conversation, because what happens is, particularly from an action learning perspective, is not only do you get the chatter about, oh my God, can you believe she said that? Or did you see his face when he rolled his eyes at her? You get that kind of conversation going on. But you also get people coming up with their own strategies on how the problem needs to be dealt with, which other people haven't been party to that conversation. And then quite often they'll say, oh, you know, John and I were just having a chat over coffee. We were thinking about what you just said in the meeting, and we think we should now do this. And, you know, other people have then been left out of that conversation, which equally damages that trust dynamic. So, my point on that, I guess, is just a takeaway for listeners in terms of trying to, you know, manage that type of thing, is to perhaps say, let's agree that when we have a break, we don't talk about the content of the meeting until we're all back together.
Yeah, and I guess to jump a little bit up the triangle or up the steps a little bit, if don't invite me to a meeting where you want me to be part of a decision-making process if you're going to make the decisions, just the two of you outside of the meeting.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you've just wasted my time. And I'm not going to buy into it. It's your decision. You know, it's nothing to do with me, and you'll get no accountability from me whatsoever. Okay, so Gary and Lisa, have you had any thoughts about trust? Have you? I'm very interested to hear, you know, any anecdotes you've got about times where you've been in like low trust environments, high trust environments. What made the difference between one and the other?
I think, I don't know whether it was the size of company I was working in, but I think I've had various different ones. So when I used to work at the college, our sort of marketing team was probably almost a sort of team within the college as a whole. I think education is sometimes notorious anyway for not having a lot of trust amongst different departments and stuff. So I think we always felt within our own team there was trust. We had a couple of occasions where that got rocked a little bit, and that was down to purely two personalities, which made it difficult for the rest of us at the time. But I think that only came because of the trust within the organisation as a whole. And it was all around jobs and, maternity leave and all this sort of stuff going on and the people
Can I ask you, Lisa, in that scenario, the high trust scenario, would you have felt comfortable walking into a team meeting and saying, I was doing this and I've properly messed it up and I need some help?
At different times I would have done at the college, and actually within my own team, yes. But I think I felt I had much more of that when I worked in a smaller family company. So when I left the college and took redundancy, I started helping out at a friend's letting agents and ended up being there for 6 years. And looking back on it, whether it's because they were family run and there were far less of us, so you being less people, you do sort of rely on those people a bit more, and whether that made it. But I actually think the systems we put in place while I was there probably helped with how much trust there was. So a big part of my job towards probably, I think I'd been there 2 years and I was coming to the end of my degree that they supported. And I think one of the projects kind of started this whole thing of setting up processes and things in place. And I think that really helped, because as a business, they needed to know how they functioned and how everything worked, because they needed to free up time for the owners to take time off. So they'd worked in the business themselves about 4 or 5 years without a real proper holiday. And part of that was because they knew everything. They knew how to do everything, and they didn't have anyone else that knew how to do certain key things. So part of my job was working with them to build those processes in so that other people could take on jobs and they could have a holiday. So for them, that was a massive thing of trust, especially around finances and the end of month accounts and all those sort of jobs. And within the team, they were looking at having to trust their own dad to do jobs, which even that became strange, because you'd think as a family member, that's where your ultimate trust is. But it was more than having to trust the abilities of those people in a work environment. But I think having the processes in place really helped, because it made everybody accountable for every job that happened within that business. And if something went wrong, we could track it all back. But I think it made us feel safe as employees to say, yeah, we've messed up, I've forgotten to do this, and this now means this. And quite often, if in that job, if you, there were certain things you could make mistakes on that would have financial repercussions, or it would definitely reflect on the service to a landlord or a tenant. But I think none of us would ever feel uncomfortable in that job to say, we've messed up, what can I do to fix it? They were also quite big as a company in that environment for people to bring up issues and raise things that they didn't think were quite right. And it was very much built around, this is the problem, this is why it's a problem, this is what it's causing and the repercussions of it, but here's some ideas of how I think it could change. And that worked really well, because I think it raised, it made the teams or the members within the team feel like their input was valued. But it gave the owners a chance to really assess what staff were doing, and to be able to come back with proper feedback and either implement things because, yeah, that's a great idea, or we can't do that right now. But they'd always be able to reason. So you constantly felt valued. But, yeah, the biggest thing with that was the accountability. So no one could ever not, they could always work out where something had gone wrong and then be able to change something. So I think because of that, we felt quite comfortable if we'd messed up being able to say that. But the team was much smaller. I think at the college, the teams were much bigger, and that made it more difficult. And within our own little team, it wasn't so bad. But when you then became the team within the rest of the college, there was always issues. And as I said, it was, it's even down to the game plan, and then it becomes political because you're kind of almost going up against other departments. And yeah, you'd have one person saying, oh, but I did that, and it would be one against the other word for word. And yeah, unless you could prove anything, it came down to, yeah, kind of who was trusted most, I suppose.
We
that was a bit difficult.
We will get on towards the end of the series, round about cast 5 or 6 of this particular series. We'll get on to discuss first and second teams. And what I mean by first and second teams is, so your first team should always be the highest team of in the organization, of which you are an active part of in terms of making decisions. So you might be on a senior leadership team or an executive team, And then beneath you, then you have your functional teams, because as part of that senior leadership team, you're maybe a head of department or a function head. And so to provide a bit of context, your first team would be that senior leadership team. And then the second team would be your functional team. So the people who report to you. We will get on to discuss that dynamic, because there's often a lot of conflict for people at that point, because they sometimes feel more akin to their people than they do to their peers. And that's an interesting psychological dynamic, which we will address in full in a future cast. Gary, I'm very interested now in your experience, because you've had situations where you are like a single contributor as a consultant. You've also worked as part of a journalistic team and various other teams. Talk to us a little bit about your experiences regarding trust in the context in which we're talking about it.
Yes, we've been talking a lot about culture, and I think that's really important. And it certainly seems in my career history and work history seems to be very much what is part of the difference. So, for example, when I was in journalism working on daily regionals, at one paper, I was one of a team of specialist correspondents, and our work was stifled by our team leader. And that was a really difficult way of working, because you just didn't feel, that you were trusted or respected.
What do you mean stifled, Gary? Sorry.
So as a specialist, you're covering a certain topic. So I was an education correspondent. We had a health correspondent, crime correspondent, and a political correspondent. So we all have our field of specialist knowledge, contacts, expertise, and that's what we were all brought into the newspaper to do. And then you'd have a team of general reporters who would cover general news. So the general reporters, for example, would be given a lot of the work. So it might be through a press release or a phone call comes through from the public. Whereas for the specialists, it was very much about you go out and find the stories. You know, you're the expert. You go and find the stories and the features. So to do that does require really good connections and contacts. I mean, any journalist will tell you that your contacts book is your most important piece of stationery you'll ever have. And getting to know people. So to get to know people, you can do that a little bit on the phone, but anybody, for example, in the current situation will know that the difference between having a team meeting on Zoom or on Teams compared to an in-person meeting, it's a really different dynamic, and it's a very different feel, and also I think the outcomes are different as well. It's just not the same thing. So if you're expecting people to really get to know people and to gain people's trust, particularly if they are people who in the past have had some run-ins with that newspaper, so they don't particularly trust the paper, and then they're thinking, well, you know, we're just going to get slammed again. there's a building bridges job to do, and that needs in-person contact. And it needs, you need to get out of the office. And that was, very much the battle was, do you need to go out to see this person? Yes, I do. Do you need to take a photographer? Yes, I do. it was really frustrating, to the point where I actually left that organization. And funnily enough, I'm told that within about a year, the other three also left. I think it was just, if you like, that sort of just opened people's eyes to the fact that, yeah, there wasn't a very good room to be working in when you just didn't feel as if you were being allowed to do your job that you've been brought in to do. And as often with jobs, you're promised much in the interview and told this is how it's going to be, and then sometimes the reality doesn't quite match up to that.
Okay. Do you have a scenario where you worked in a high trust environment?
What I would say, yes. So just sort of going back to the sort of journalism. So with another newspaper, which again was a similar type of newspaper, just in a different region, There, it was different because I was still a specialist correspondent, but they allowed me to concentrate on, you know, getting the stories and features. So they got a very productive me. They got a steady stream of stories. They got someone who is able to build up those connections. So when you're on a deadline and you're needing to, you know, contact a councillor or an officer from the council or an MP, for example, you know, you, because you've built up a little bit of rapport with and relationship with these people, they're more likely to speak to you. So it's, you know, so it's all round much, much better. And obviously, you know, whilst being more productive, it was also less stressful for me because I knew that if there were certain other bits that needed to be added into the story, they could ask one of the general reporters to kind of build that in and cover that. So it was just a much better working relationship, and we could talk. The, you know, the relationship with the news desk was much better. It could be, you know, I could say to them, you know, what do you need, and they can come to me at times and say, oh, you know, yeah, we want that, can you make it this many words, and then you could do another piece which is this many words, and then it's just much easier because it just, everybody knows where they are. So that was much better. In terms of, I suppose, the best example where there was trust was probably when I was working with a charity in Merseyside, working with adults with learning disabilities, and there they did set it up really well for the support workers. I was a development worker there, and I was looking after a particular group in a particular area of Merseyside, and you had your line manager, but yeah, we had regular meetings where you could just be very open about how things were going, and you were, I felt listened to, and they understood, and where they could help, they did, and things improved where they needed to be improved, and where there were things which I needed to address, you know, they were very supportive in saying, you know, let's see if we can do this and that, so that worked really well, and that certainly made that, you know, those sort of 4 years of the charity, again, very productive, and, you know, we got some very good outcomes for the people there.
Mm.
And okay. I would say, because I think you asked also about what the difference is between the two. So I would say, for me, I think respect and kind of mutual respect. So certainly as a journalist, I wanted to be respected for my skill and my knowledge. You know, I wasn't a junior. I wasn't a fresh face, you know, at these newspapers. You know, I'd served my apprenticeship. I've done all my qualifications, and I had several years, you know, doing this stuff. So it wasn't as if I was just coming in as a starter. Better communication. So I think, again, just talking and just a bit more openness, really.
Mm.
That helped. And again, I think the sort of the quality of the leadership and the culture. So I could probably say, if I looked at the culture where it was a better culture, there was more trust, and there was a better, you know, a better feeling when coming into work. You know, that's because that's, you know, and I think that's important. Yes, of course, we've got work to do, and it's not always going to be fun. You're going to have days which are difficult, challenging, and so on. But you should feel as if, you know, yes, I'm happy coming into work.
Mm. Thank you, Gary. How do we go about building a high trust environment in our team? And I would say, for me, one of the most important things to build this particular type of trust that we're talking about here is everybody needs to care about everybody else on an emotional level. Now, I know in my industry, a lot of people, as soon as they hear that, they'll groan and they'll go, oh, we're going all soft and gooey. Come on, stop it. But genuinely, when I talk to a lot of people in the workshops that I run, and when I ask them to describe, so what I tend to do is on a piece of flip chart paper, I'll draw a line down the middle, and I'll have on the left-hand side high trust, and on the right-hand side low trust. and I'll ask them to give me words that best describe what it was about those two scenarios. And I got to tell you, a lot of the words that come out in the high trust are all emotional words. So they tend to be words like caring and open. And, you know, I've had people even talk about love in that sort of scenario, of having a love for each other in their team. So it's there, you know, these things are, as human beings, we thrive in teams because we're able to make emotional connections with each other that make us greater than the sum of our parts. That's what holds real high-performing teams together. They care for each other. And because they care for each other, they look after each other, they trust each other, and they want to do the very best they can for each other. And that's ultimately the difference. So just with that in mind, and that's just my idea. I'm not trying to impart that on anybody. I'm just saying this is what I find. And this is what I feel myself from my own experience. So in terms of you putting your team together, what sort of things do you think it would be important to do initially to start to engage that level of trust? Because employers will often talk about demanding trust. They demand trust from their employees. You can't demand trust from somebody. Trust is something that it's an emotional thing. It's intangible. Somebody either feels safe enough with you to be vulnerable or they don't. You can't tell somebody to be vulnerable with you. You know, be vulnerable with me. You can trust me. They have to feel it. Words just don't work. So what does a team leader do to start to build that trust within their team?
I think in all the jobs I've had, actually, one of the big things is about sharing info and encouraging that. So from whatever level that information might come from, I think it's feeling like you're in the know and that decisions you make are then kind of in line with everything else that's going on, or that you know if you're doing particular work tasks that whatever you're doing is having some sort of input somewhere.
How do you know that unless you're getting recognition?
It's knowing, and maybe this again is down to sizes of company and when that works, but it shouldn't matter actually. Even a team within a big one should be able to work it. But I think it's having leaders and stuff have those conversations with you where you feel like you're being bought into those circles, I suppose. So if they've been sat at a team leader meeting and they come back. So good example, when we've probably the last boss I had in the marketing team when I worked at the college, he would have to go to certain management meetings. On the where he had management meetings booked in, that would always get followed up an hour later with a team meeting. So he would come back and relay everything he learned at that team meeting. And we would then work out how that was affecting the latest projects we were working on or the latest marketing campaigns. He would never keep that to himself. And I think probably because he thought, well, there's no point. Like, I can go and sit at this meeting because I've got the title of manager, but actually it's my team that are working on those specific projects that need to know this stuff because it's affecting what they're working on. So I think with him, there was always a very, and I suppose that's probably because he trusted us ultimately to share that information with. He knew that the stuff that couldn't be shared outside of those four walls wouldn't go anywhere, but it meant that we could then be confident in the jobs we were doing and we could ask the questions we needed. That if he didn't know, he was always quite open with saying, "Do you know what? I don't know that, but I will find out and I'll come back to you." But he was quite big on team meetings generally. Like, we would generally have a chat first thing every morning, most mornings, to go through what we did. He'd encourage us to say, well, what are your challenges today? And even when I then went to the letting agents, we had a morning meeting every day. And that was our, again, it was our chance to be able to say in front of everybody, I'm struggling with this. This isn't going to get done, but it needs to get done. And that's where everyone would then pull together to make sure that things didn't get missed. So, yeah, I think that was a big thing, was just having those sort of opening up communication and knowing you could ask those questions or admit defeat with something, knowing that you were then going to get the support to actually see it through. Mm-hmm. So I think that was probably a really big thing that I've probably experienced in most jobs. Yeah, just feeling part of something bigger, I suppose.
You see, in the book, Patrick Lencioni talks about, well, as I've said earlier, you can't, trust is not something, you can't just put a sign on the wall saying, in this team we trust. It's an intangible, it's an emotional thing that most people can't really rationalize. Why do you trust X person over Y person? I'm not quite sure. I just feel I can trust X more than I can trust Y. Because it's an emotional response as opposed to a rational one. But there was two little exercises he kind of gave in the book, in the fable, he called it a fable, not a parable. Parable's a religious thing, I think, isn't it? In the fable at the start of the book. So what they did was, on the first day of their off-site meeting, they did a little exercise around the table where they all had to give over, I think it was 5 pieces of information about themselves. It was their hometown, how many siblings, I think it was something to do about like a team sport they played. What was their first job? And there was one other, I can't quite remember what it was. And it was just so that you could start to get to know the person behind the name and the role and the persona, because I think we've already talked about it previously, where we often come to work with a persona, and we use that persona to protect ourselves because there are things going on in our lives that we don't necessarily want our work colleagues to know about. And so we put on a face. So this was a means of sort of getting behind that face. But also what they did in advance of the offsite, they had all undertaken a Myers-Briggs type test exercise. And at the offsite, to sort of start building up on the trust, they each shared their Myers-Briggs results and they talked about what that meant for them and for them as part of the wider team and how the team would best engage with them because of the information they'd learned on the Myers-Briggs. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that, you know, organizations should do Myers-Briggs or DISC or any of that, but it certainly can be an if used appropriately. So not used as a label or a stick to beat people with or something to pigeonhole people with. Something like that can be helpful in terms of identifying to a team, okay, so I'm maybe an introvert. So, you know, the best way to connect with me with respect to stuff is to not kind of put me on the spot or to expect me to do something like as a presentation or something, because that's not my preference. I'm outside of my comfort zone. And to just understand that, to start to understand each individual's kind of vulnerabilities so that you can empathize with them and work with them to support them, rather than seeing it as he's an extrovert, or he's an introvert, so I'm gonna really start putting him under pressure because, you know, I just can. So I come back to, again, ideas for what we could do in those first weeks, months with our new team to start to try to build that trust.
I think that's good. I was going to say that I've been involved in exercises like that. One of which was actually at a coaching course where they actually got people to talk to each other and tell each other about each other, then your partner would actually introduce you to the rest of the group. So there was a listening exercise as well as a sharing exercise. But that also allowed people to see people's personalities and character come out as well. But I think we may have talked before about having a support buddy or someone who helps to show you the ropes, someone that you can turn to help understand your needs and wants, and also vice versa. You can understand more about, well, you know, what are they expecting from me? I think I've talked before about, you know, that respect. And I think part of that comes from, you know, as you say, it's slightly intangible, but you can sense a culture, you can sense how someone is, and you can pick up on that. And I think that is all part of what forms your picture of what the organization and what the people around you are all about. And I think another example of that is where, you know, if people say something, oh yes, we'll get that, you know, lamp or desk or chair or whatever it is for you for next week, and then next week it's not there. It's, you know, it's again, if it's not words backed by action, then, you know, well, you know, that says something, doesn't it?
I think there's a few things of trust. I think the first thing is to be curious. So that brings me back to my whole coaching thing, is that, you know, if you want to build trust with somebody, you need to be curious about where they're coming from. You need to understand what their approach might be. Be curious, ask them questions rather than you do the telling rather than listening and taking a step back. That really isn't going to enhance trust. So I think taking on a slight more coaching approach, doing more listening than talking, I think helps to build that trust. I think finding out about people and being curious, I think, is a really, really big thing here. Something that has come up quite a few times, not just on today's conversation, but over kind of a few of the other podcasts as well, around like the role of the manager and, you know, how they show up in discussions and group discussions. And the regular team meeting that we were talking about a minute ago at the start of the day, I think they're all very helpful. But I think the big piece around that is that freedom within boundaries, so that if you're having those meetings in the morning, that people have then got the freedom to go off and do what they need to do within that framework that you set, which is, you know, the time scale or the budget, or, you know, these are the three things this project has to deliver on. But you are given the autonomy to then go away and make that happen. I think that you have to, you can't just earn that autonomy. You know, trust has to be something that is gradually gained, like I was saying earlier about the emotional bank account. But I think you need to start giving people autonomy in order for them to realize that you trust them, in order for them to trust you back. It's a reciprocal thing. If you're trusted, then the chances are you're going to trust that person back in return. So I think that is equally a really key thing when it comes to building that team relationship.
Imagine for a minute you've got like almost like somebody who assumes the chief exec role, and you've got somebody who's looking after finance, and you've got somebody who's looking after operations, and maybe you somebody who's looking after HR, and somebody who's, you know, and all the different functions you'd expect to have in a normal business. You're the chief exec. You've got your team of volunteers. Day one is your first staff meeting. And you want to make it very clear to everybody that you intend to create an environment of high trust. What would you do on that first day?
I would go back to that vulnerability piece, and I would ask everybody to share their, you know, the thing they failed at, the thing that they've learned from, the thing that was like a really big mistake for them. And let's start building a place of trust from that position of vulnerability. So sharing that learning, you know, what could you learn from, you know, very much a growth mindset perspective, because then not only are you saying this is a safe space, we're not judging you, we are here for us all to learn from our mistakes, grow together. And the chances are, I mean, when I've seen this happen before in exercises that I've run, people start connecting with each other over their failures. And they're like, oh my gosh, that happened to me too. Or tell me more about what happened, because I think I had a similar experience. And people start connecting through those things. But it's a very bold statement to say that we take you as a human being for all your flaws, for all the things that haven't worked out for you. And we open the floor up to you for that. Now, you mentioned quite a key point earlier, Ray, around the difference between introverts and extroverts. And I think you also have to acknowledge in that space that some people are introverts and will not feel comfortable having those conversations, and that it's absolutely okay to acknowledge that and be okay in that space, which then helps people that are in that situation that thinking, there's no way I can sit here and just openly talk to 20 people about something that I did wrong. That's fine. And acknowledge that that's fine. And if you don't want to share, that's absolutely fine. And I think making sure that you are catering, not just for your preference, I mean, me being an extrovert, I just walk around the world thinking everyone else is extroverted. But actually, lots of people aren't wired the way that I'm wired. So I think making sure in that very first conversation you're having with that kickoff in the meeting is to acknowledge that and be very open and clear about that it's okay to be who you are.
Can I come back to you on that? And say this, that because the next piece is to do with avoidance of conflict. So part of the reason that you might want to do the Myers-Briggs and to talk about that is that just because somebody is an introvert doesn't necessarily mean that they are more averse to conflict or sharing. It just means that it needs to be done in a slightly different way. Ultimately, at the end of the day, your first conversation with a team, whether it's a team that you've just brought together or a team that you've come in to turn around, maybe because they've not been performing very well, is that the advice is that you share the whole model first of all. And you say that we all have to be willing to engage with all of these elements in order to get to the top. And it's okay for somebody at that point to turn around and say, do you know what, this isn't for me, and to decide to leave, because that's what's best for the team. Now, that's not necessarily the people who would feel uncomfortable with sharing, because sharing can be done in a number of different ways. And it is, that's why it is important, if you're going to do something like Myers-Briggs, that you get a professional to do it. So you get a professional analysis of the results first, so that you as the team leader are more informed about in advance of some of the potential vulnerabilities of members of your team, because the last thing you want to do is create an environment that is adverse to a particular character type just because you haven't considered their wants and needs enough. But ultimately, at the end of the day, whatever your character type or character preference, because these things are all a spectrum and it's about preference as opposed to you are this, you are that. Because I'm an introvert in a lot of things, but in some things I'm very extrovert because that's just me. And I think a lot of people are like that, actually. It is to understand that, so that when you're creating the scenario by where you're going to have the trust. And this is why I will say at this point, I am absolutely delighted. I want to hug you all. That nobody has suggested that we go on some sort of an SAS retreat where we have to climb trees and climb cliffs and, you know, bridge fjords and all that sort of thing. Because I think that they're very gimmicky and actually teach you very, very little about your team and do very little in terms of trust. But it can be done in a much more gentle, subtle and warm and cozy way, so that people feel comfortable. And at the end of the day, if people ultimately don't want to share or can't share, then that potentially is going to create a problem further down the line, because again, they'll be more reticent to admit that they need help or admit that they're failing on something. And that ultimately is bad for the team. But it might just be that you've got to play a slightly longer game and put it there for them and allow them to come to it rather than you pushing it on them. It's a fine balance, and a leader, a manager, a supervisor needs to be very much aware in this process, because if you go at it like a bull in a china shop, you'll probably do more harm than good. This is about connecting with people on an emotional level. And for a lot of us, me included, or me especially, I would have said, until relatively recently, that was something that I was almost incapable of doing. And through the beauty of self-development and therapy and everything else that I've shared, that's got a lot easier. It's not perfect, and I always have to work on it. And sometimes I kind of forget myself, or if I'm feeling a bit vulnerable, I revert to type and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I appreciate that there are different character types and you have to bring people along maybe at different speeds. But ultimately, in a team, for a team to work, you cannot have a situation where people are holding back or where they feel that they cannot be themselves, because that's where politics lie. And politics in a team environment can be very, very damaging and debilitating. That's all I'd just say on that as a predominantly introverted person. Join us soon for the next part of our 5 Dysfunctions of a Team series, where we will talk about conflict. They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of